Coming up on Weekend America.
For stranded sea mammals, help can come too late.
If that animal looks at me, opens its eye, and it's very alert, that's a quick way to assess how that animal's doing. If the animal doesn't open its eye and it sits there flat, then that's not a good sign.
This weekend, tough love on the beach. I'm Desiree Cooper.
And I'm Bill Radke. This Kentucky Derby weekend, meet a man who took his race calling job seriously.
At one point, he suffers a heart attack and still made it to the track. At another point, he was thrown off a horse and broke his hip and, you know, again made it to the track.
The incredible winning streak of Joe Hernandez. And later, Jewish klezmer music gets a new attitude.
It's an attitude of knock the door down, a tatter roof off the sucker. That is not in klezmer, but we put it in klezmer.
Tear the roof off the temple, coming up on Weekend America.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to The Weekend. I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul, Minnesota.
And I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles. Cinco de Mayo is being celebrated in advance this weekend. Bit of a soggy track for tonight's Kentucky Derby. And klezmer funk hip-hop is at the Apollo tonight, and it's on our show later this hour. What are you doing this weekend?
I thought I'd camp out and get tickets to the Elton John concert. It's pretty crazy having Elton John in Fairbanks, Alaska.
More than likely, playing video games all weekend.
I want to play Grand Theft Auto, but can't afford it yet.
This weekend, I'm going to a party with a bunch of people who are circus artists.
This weekend, I am going to go see Iron Man as many times as I can possibly fit it in.
I love cartoon movies. Very excited about Iron Man.
Iron Man, Iron Man, Iron Man, all weekend long.
Imagine Elton John dressed as Iron Man on stage.
If I'm not mistaken, Elton John has some iron toupees in his very large and diverse collection. Those voices came to us from Charleston, West Virginia, St. Louis, and Fairbanks, Alaska.
Well, this week, Mexican authorities have been looking out for sharks near Acapulco. That's where a shark killed a California man as he was surfing on Monday. It's not always the human animals, however, who are threatened by the creatures of the sea. Sometimes it's the sea mammals who are threatened by the creatures of the beach. Like when dolphins get stuck on the sand, they can be out of luck, even when found by compassionate marine biologists. From Wilmington, North Carolina, Megan Verley has more.
Marine biologist Bill McClellan stands at the high tide line at North Carolina's Wrightsville Beach. Around him, sunbathers and sandy kids enjoy the afternoon, but McClellan knows how quickly this idyllic scene can turn to surprise and horror. Last year, 19 sea mammals washed, crawled, or flopped ashore on North Carolina's beaches. They got stranded, and in most cases, McClellan was called to the scene.
One of the first things I do when I walk up to a live animal is I just whistle at it really loudly. Since these animals are all acoustically oriented their whole life, if that animal looks at me, opens its eye, and it's very alert, that's a quick way to assess how that animal's doing right there on the beach. If the animal doesn't open its eye and it sits there basically flat, then that's not a good sign.
McClellan has helped run the Marine Mammal Stranding Network for a dozen years. The first call he got after arriving in North Carolina was to save a stranded dolphin on a remote beach. McClellan's team named it Benny. They devoted weeks to caring for the sick creature, standing hip-deep in pools with the dolphin day and night, trying to get it strong enough for transfer to a long-term facility.
And Benny would start, one day he'd look really good, and the next day he wouldn't look good. And one day you'd get ready to think about the transfer, and the next day he'd be kind of lethargic in the pool, and all the parameters were never really stable enough to transfer him.
Despite all their efforts, Benny didn't make it. But he was a learning experience. In 4 months, this one dolphin's care cost nearly $200,000, all of it donated. McClellan says these days researchers must weigh an animal's chances against its potential cost for all but the most endangered species.
For instance, right whales. There's only 395 of them left. You're going to go to every possible avenue to try to keep that animal alive. We're seeing these animals that are wrapped up in fishing gear. There's whole teams of folks that will go out there and risk their lives to try to cut this gear off these animals so they have a chance to survive.
But right whales are the exception. Not long ago, McClellan's counterparts in Virginia found three deepwater dolphins struggling in a muddy tidal creek. They tried to get the dolphins to swim back out to sea, but it didn't work. In the end, the creatures arrived at McClellan's lab, just in a very different condition than you might expect.
Well, we'll do the tooth. Remind me that we'll do the tooth count once we get the head off, because it'll be easier to open up the jaws.
Ann Pabst is McClellan's partner in North Carolina's Stranding Network. She's about to dissect one of the dolphins, so fresh and intact it could almost be a rubber museum model. It's hard to watch as a student's scalpel divides the beautiful creature into a grid of red lines. Whenever a stranded animal is euthanized, researchers try to glean as much information as possible from the corpse. In part, Papp says, out of a moral obligation to an animal they couldn't save, but also because under the Marine Mammal Protection Act, it's the only time researchers can legally dissect these species.
So what we'll do is collect a suite of health and biological data and then work with colleagues around the country to assess those data and those tissue samples to determine, as best we can, the cause of death of these animals.
Cause of death is important for finding out if any human actions are hurting the population, like certain fishing practices or sonar signals from boats. Data from necropsies, that's the word for animal autopsies, led the government to propose speed limits for ships in certain areas to keep them from hitting right whales. But the information gleaned from each marine mammal corpse goes far beyond the purely practical.
That animal can provide scientists and students with data and tissues that they can use for various studies, going from just how did this animal make its living to what sorts of diseases to how does its body work as a mammalian body in a marine environment.
Necropsies may help scientists make sense of marine mammal strandings and give the deaths a larger purpose, but they're cold comfort for the crowds watching on the beach. When four pygmy killer whales washed ashore on Myrtle Beach last year, police cars were needed to hold back the curious. McClellan is often in the middle of these scenes. He's helped introduce children to the idea of death. He's seen punches thrown, and he's weathered the outcry of animal rights activists.
I do feel that's one of the worst things that happens is at times when you have an event that plays out over a mile or two of beach and you can't get to everybody. You can't just tell everybody what you're going to be doing. And I'm sure that there's miscommunications at that. We do draw crowds together and have people tell them what we're up to.
It's vital for McClellan and his fellow researchers to make sure these crowds understand what's going on. Most of their work is funded through public donations. If responders begin to be seen as nothing more than hit squads, that could really hurt their budgets. So McClellan must always keep his audience in mind.
It's a funny situation. Everybody tells me I look callous when I'm out there. I'm internally at war with these kind of decisions, but if you have to make those decisions, I don't want to look like there's any doubt. We want to be very just straightforward in our response and what we're doing.
After years of responding to strandings, McClellan knows he's doing the right thing. He says the big concern now is helping the public understand why most of the desperate sea mammals they encounter on the beach will never return to the open waves. In Wilmington, North Carolina, I'm Megan Verlee for Weekend America.
For a slideshow and also a video of workers trying to rescue a stranded dolphin, you can go to our website, weekendamerica.org.
This is Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. The presidential primaries move on to Guam today, North Carolina and Indiana on Tuesday. It's been an unusually protracted battle. Weekend America's John Moe has been following the race closely. And John, you have come across some interesting information.
That's right, Bill. I have obtained some documents from deep inside the Hillary Clinton campaign, extremely high level and top secret. Now, never mind how I got them. You don't really want to know. But this is going to blow the lid off this whole campaign. And I don't know how to say this, but she's trying to lose. Hillary's taking a dive, Bill.
What? Are you serious?
Serious as a heart attack. This is big news.
John, it doesn't make any sense. Why would she want to lose?
Well, according to what I've learned here, they have taken a clear-eyed view of the situation over at Hillary Clinton campaign headquarters. They see an unpopular war, economy in recession. We got the housing market. You got high gas prices. She realizes being president is a sucker's job.
Then why is she running?
Excellent question. Based on what I have learned, 2008 is actually a stealth campaign for 2012. The thinking is things can't get any worse, ergo they eventually have to get better later. So let someone else preside over the mess, swoop in as a hero in 4 years.
Oh, but she's been campaigning so hard, John. It seems like she wants this very badly.
Yeah, she's good. That's what makes the illusion work. Look, going into this, she was organized, connected, she was the favorite, she was the inevitable nominee. And that's not what she wanted. So she had Bill Clinton call Obama's candidacy a fairy tale, thus blowing the African-American vote. And then an easily disproved story about dodging sniper fire.
But couldn't those have just been campaign mistakes?
Well, look, either Bill and Hillary Clinton, who never lose elections, just got really careless all of a sudden, or they wanted to lose.
So you're saying the path is clear for Barack Obama?
Well, it would be clear, but he is also trying to lose.
What?
Yes, I did more digging. I met a guy in a parking garage. I got some information. Look, Obama's smart. He wants to lose, but he was up against that powerful Clinton defeat machine. Before he knew it, he was rattling off 11 straight victories, drowning in delegates. He knew a win in Pennsylvania would seal his fate. So what does he do? Rolls out advisor/operative Jeremiah Wright.
And all those flag pin questions and Resco and Ayers.
Yep. Obviously planted by the Obama team.
Wow. So you're telling me that John McCain is the next president?
Whoa. No. Not if he has anything to do with it.
Are you saying John McCain is...
John McCain is in on it too, Bill. The Republicans desperately want to stick the upcoming mess on a Democrat. So out of the entire GOP, they found the one guy who absolutely no constituency was excited about. Then they sent him out in favor of a war that 63% of Americans say was a bad idea. In this race to lose the White House, do not underestimate the Republicans, Bill.
So what happens next then, John, in this race for the or race away from the White House?
Well, it's too close to call. Hillary's camp seems confident she can run out the clock and be gone by June. But Obama is planning a few more surprises. Apparently he read some Karl Marx in college or something. It's small stuff. It's dumb stuff, but stuff that we know works. And as for the Republicans, well, McCain's 100 years in Iraq comment is going to be tough to beat.
You mean tough to not beat?
Yeah, exactly. These three candidates are so skilled at reverse politics, it's just a shame one of them has to win.
John, you have given us a lot to think about. What does all this mean for November?
One of three things. President Paul, President Gravel, or President Nader. The voters will decide.
You heard it here first. Weekend America's John Moe.
Is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week. And by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Tables, How to Eat Supper, the latest cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat.
Coming up, goodbye, Reverend. Hello, Jimi Hendrix. And human males will disappear. Good news, bad news, or no news? Next on Weekend America. From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. This is the part of the show where we divide the week's events into good news, bad news, or no news. And joining us for the first time, Dudley Clendenin. His latest book, A Place Called Canterbury, looks at how the oldest Americans are dealing with the reality of living longer. Welcome, Dudley.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Also, author and humorist Patricia Marks, former Saturday Night Live writer, and many more. Welcome back, Patricia.
Thank you.
And our good friend, Hollywood mogul, writer, producer, John Ridley. Hi, John.
You know, it's always a pleasure, Bill. Always a pleasure.
I know that. Our first topic, Senator Barack Obama's ex-pastor this week continued to praise Louis Farrakhan and suggest the government created HIV and say the U.S. was attacked because of its own terrorism. And Obama finally disavowed him. Is that good news, bad news, or no news?
I think it's good news because he needed to do it. I also think it's fair because we all have friends who don't fit with us on some things, but you have to say so when it becomes true.
I think this is also good news for any monk or other clergy person who's taken a vow of silence, because politicians need religious mentors, mm-hmm. and those guys are going to be in very high demand.
I think this is it's good news that Obama did it, he had to do it. He had no choice but to do it. And I'd written some things and tried to support the black liberation theology and all that kind of stuff. But eventually you just got to say, you know what? You're drunk. And there's nothing I can do about your drunkenness. And put your pants on and go home. And so it's good.
So you disagreed with everything Pastor Wright said?
I didn't disagree. You know, there were things that he honestly had said that he talks about, you know, black folks, you know, taking care of ourselves and being self-reliant and all that. And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, when you look at systemic segregation, what else are you going to say? But when somebody says, look, you're going to go on the world stage, I just really need you to not mention that AIDS was created in a lab at the bottom of the Pentagon. Could you just not say that one thing? And that's the first thing you say. I mean, what are you going to do? So I think that's where it becomes difficult, where a guy goes out of his way to cause you problems. And Jeremiah Wright was like, I don't care. I made you. I'll break you. He's like my dad. I brought you into this world to take you out of this world.
You know, but there's also another part of the lesson, which more seriously is that wise men can be radical in part and not make a lot of sense in some of what they say. And, you know, this country was radical to begin with. And it was founded so people could be radical. But you have to be able to say when you don't agree and when they offend you. And he sure couldn't have waited any longer.
Our next topic, U.S. House members get their cars paid for by taxpayers. This week, the New York Times reported that those cars are often low mileage, high priced, and foreign. Does that sound like good news, bad news, or no news?
Could you underline
foreign, John?
I was okay until you didn't tell me they were illegal alien cars, Bill. Okay, now I'm against it.
I think, you know, the Senate is smart enough not to let their members have cars like this, so they must
think.
What's
that? Only the House.
What's wrong with it is that we end up paying for their cars and at least deals, and their staff does all the shopping, and they just, you know, they may say, get me a BMW, but they don't ever have any experience of direct contact in spending the money and knowing what things cost. That's part of what's wrong with the system.
So the system is bad news.
Yeah.
We have to dumb ourselves down.
That's what the test says.
Exactly.
In some ways, and I'm a little, you know, I'm outraged and upset and, you know, everything that Dudley said, these guys are out of touch and all that. I have to put it to no news in the sense that these guys represent us, and a lot of us, if they're not foreign vehicles, are at least driving big gas-guzzling vehicles that get low mileage and are not appropriate for where oil is now and how much it costs in our environmental footprint.
But one congressman gives constituents rides in his Cadillac, and he said he wants them to feel that they are somebody and their congressman is somebody.
It's Charles Rangel. Look, I'll say it as a black man. Charles Rangel from Harlem got a big old Cadillac to give brothers a ride around in. Come on. He's playing into the stereotype.
Our next topic, an Oxford University genetics professor predicts the human male will disappear in 125,000 years. He says the Y chromosome is deteriorating and cannot repair itself, so men are doomed. Is that good news, bad news, or not news?
I think it's what women have been saying forever. Men make a big mess and then they exit.
Mm-hmm. I bet Hillary's hoping that complete extinction would take place before November.
All I need is two.
I think it's good news because, 125,000 years from now, women will finally start to appreciate us. Once we're gone, oh, yeah. Ladies, yeah. Oh, you're going to need your tires rotated. Oh, there's a spider. Who's going to get that for you, ladies? You're on your own. Yeah. Good luck. And you know what? 125,000 years from now, they're going to be giant
spiders. Spiders are going to be huge.
They're going to be huge. And another thing, Bill, you and I have talked about this so many times. The apes aren't going to step in.
Yes, that's true.
You think, who's going to protect you from the apes, ladies, when they try to take over? Not us.
Whose DNA are they going to keep to use later on?
Oh. That's actually a good question.
Yeah, I mean, the competition's going to be awful.
I think it'll be Lenny Kravitz, from what I understand.
We should have seen this coming, though, with the invention of luggage on wheels, because, you know, the reason for men was just getting smaller.
Our time was clearly
diminishing.
First harbinger. Yeah. Okay, our final topic. 2 weeks ago, a New York collectibles dealer claimed to have brokered the sale of a Marilyn Monroe sex film. Now a studio has released a DVD called Jimi Hendrix, The Sex Tape. Dead celebrities supposedly captured in the act. Is this good news, bad news, or no news?
Worst news ever.
Worst news ever.
Yeah.
Why?
Jimi Hendrix is our collection of cool to this point, even past his death. And by the way, we don't know for a fact it's Jimi Hendrix.
That's
question.
True. Right. It's question.
And to, after his death, somebody else get a hold of a tape and, you know, release that and control that image is horrible.
Bad news for the icon. Are any of the others of you iconoclasts?
You know, but this whole thing is constructed by this company on a lookalike, so they may just be marketing something of somebody who looks like Jimi Hendrix, and we could have a whole lot of tapes of people who look like. So I don't think this is so much an insult to Jimi Hendrix, because I don't really think it's him. It's more about American commerce, which can really be offensive sometimes.
I hear their next tape is The Man Who Looks a Little Like the Pope, the sex tape.
Coming out soon, yeah.
Now that I would see.
I would see that one, too.
That's the news this week. Panel, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
That's Patricia Marks. Her latest book is Him, Her, Him Again, The End of Him. Dudley Clendenin's book is called A Place Called Canterbury, Tales of the New Old Age in America. And John Ridley's latest is The American Way, a graphic novel about a government-created team of superheroes. He also writes an NPR blog called Visible Man.
Well, our good news, no news, bad news panelists will definitely not have the last word on the Jeremiah Reich, Barack Obama controversy. And so we're wondering, why don't you weigh in as well? Have you ever had a moment when you felt like you had to change the way you worshipped because of something your pastor, monk, rabbi, or imam said?
We want to hear from our church, temple, mosque-going listeners. Did you have a moment when you disagreed with someone you looked to for spiritual guidance? What was it, and what did you do?
Maybe you decided you could just live with the conflict, or maybe it was an isolated incident, or maybe it totally changed the way you looked at faith. We want to hear the story of the time that your beliefs were challenged by your religious leader and how you handled it.
Come to our virtual confessional, weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This program is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, and KPCC Los Angeles.
You've heard about Seabiscuit's glorious run, but there was another glorious run of the man who announced Seabiscuit's history-making race. Meet the record-breaking race caller, coming up on Weekend America.
Thank you.
From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. In Seattle, boating season officially begins this weekend. The Derby is on in Kentucky. And in Brooklyn, New York, it's time to admire the fall foliage. Yes, as the new leaves are arriving and growing, the old leaves are up on gallery walls. Reporter Sally Herships takes us on a walk with a woman who is turning foliage into canvases.
The buds are coming out right here on this tree. You can actually see it.
Jessica Baker is an artist. We're taking a walk in Brooklyn's Prospect Park.
Watch out for the horse duty.
For her, it's sort of like going to the art supply store, except everything she needs is free. That's because Baker prints her work on leaves.
What kind of tree is this?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. You know, it's funny. I know the leaves now better than I know the trees.
Some people might find them a nuisance, but Baker says she loves leaves. She collected most of them on rainy fall days. That's when the leaves seemed to fall the most.
And they were fresh.
So she would come out.
I would come out with my umbrella and my plastic bags. I looked kind of funny.
But for her...
For me, it was like a party. You know, my birthday. Look at all these leaves all over the place.
So she'd put the leaves in plastic bags, cart them back to her studio. But she had to rush.
Because I probably had maybe 4 or 5 days to do it before they weren't usable anymore, and then I'd have to go back out and find some more. So, you know, it was like almost a race with time.
When she got back to her studio, the first thing she did was spritz the leaves with water. This kept them from drying out and crumbling until she was ready to print. When it was finally time, she'd soak them, then blot. The leaves needed to be damp, but couldn't be too wet.
Most printmakers were baffled. They're like, what are you doing printing on leaves? So for me, it was a very interesting process.
This is how Baker's process works. She etches a drawing into a metal plate with acid, puts some colored ink on it. The ink sinks into the carved out areas. She puts a leaf on that plate, applies a lot of pressure, and out comes a print on a leaf. At least that's what she hoped for.
The amazing thing about making prints is that no matter how much you have this vision of what the print is going to look like, when you roll it through the press, the great moment is the reveal where you pick up the paper and you look down and you're like, okay, what happened? What does it look like? We go inside.
It looks like a kaleidoscope of patterns. She's printed with reds, golds, and greens. Some of the leaves are displayed in big bunches on the wall. They're on display at her solo show at a gallery in Prospect Park. Some leaves are upside down, brown and veiny, like sleeping bats.
There are ginkgo leaves on there. There are actually some small maple leaves or Japanese maple leaves on there.
Do you have a favorite leaf?
I do. It's over there.
Take a closer look at the leaves and you'll see her etchings. Concentric circles, a metaphor for the changing seasons. Her process of drying and pressing the leaves actually helps to preserve them. She doesn't know how long they'll last, but she hopes to hang on to fall as long as she can.
You know, somehow I'm sure inside of me there was this impulse to make an imprint on nature, you know, to sort of make this statement like, I was here, you know, I exist. I think probably I felt like Mother Nature in a way, you know. I think I felt like I had control over it. I was the hand.
The hand which completes the cycle. Which brings us back to...
Spring. It's kind of like I've come full circle because this whole process started in the fall and now it's spring and the leaves are coming back out and, I don't know, there's something really completing about this.
For Weekend America, Looking at Leaves, I'm Sally Herships in Prospect Park.
Jessica Baker's solo exhibit, Leaf and Circle, runs through May 26th at the Prospect Audubon Center in Brooklyn. And we have a very cool slideshow of her leafy subjects.
Yeah, you know, it's so interesting. They remind me of, like, maybe some ancient culture may have done them, like from cave dwellings or something. I don't know. They're beautiful, beautiful works of art.
They are absolutely lovely, and you can see them at weekendamerica.org. We'll be right back.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
You're listening to Weekend America. If you can't get to the Kentucky Derby this weekend, you can still feel the thrill, thanks to the announcer who'll be calling the race. Another announcer, Joe Hernandez, was the race caller at the famous Santa Anita Park in Southern California. He called a record 15,587 consecutive races over 38 years. He was a proud man, but ambivalent about his heritage. He often lied about his Mexican-American roots. He held up his Anglo second wife while denying his Mexican-American first wife. Author Rudy Alvarado has written a book about this complicated man. It's called Untold Story of Joe Hernandez, The Voice of Santa Anita. Rudy, welcome to Weekend America.
Hi, thanks. It's good to be here.
So, Rudy, Joe has often been described as one of the most charismatic callers of all time. Let's listen to him call some of the famous 1940 Seabiscuit race.
There they go. It's Specify going to the front, winning call on the rail at second. Witchy is third. Seabiscuit on the outside at fourth. Don Mike at fifth. And Royal Crusader coming down the stretch the first time. It's Witchy in front between Specify and Seabiscuit. Seabiscuit on the outside is second by an X.
Rudy, what made Joe Hernandez such a special race caller?
From that call, you can listen to the excitement that he brought to a race. Joe not only brought that excitement, but just even listen to him, you always felt as if any horse out there on that track could win that race. And it just so happened in this case that it was Seabiscuit. But he would bring such a structure to a race that by the time you listen to the first turn, down the back stretch, all the way coming back home, by the time they cross that finish line, you know, he just finished it off completely by just captivating an audience, by bringing that excitement and the tone and the words, everything together combined, just made Joe a fantastic race caller.
He also had a trademark way of opening the races.
He did. There they go.
That seems so obvious to me. No one had ever said, there they go, before.
No, never before. Joe would tell the story that his first race at Santa Anita, that he was so excited about calling that first race that he forgot that the race is about to start, and he looks up and the bell sounds and there goes the horses. And he said that he said the first thing that came to his mind, which was, there they go.
So Joe worked a lot of tracks on the West Coast, building his reputation, and eventually he becomes the race caller at Santa Anita. What was the significance of that moment?
Well, the most significant, of course, is that you have a Mexican-American becoming the race caller at what is soon to become the most prestigious track on the West Coast.
And he certainly transcended stereotypes. I mean, this guy had his fingers in a million businesses. He imported horses from South America. He recreated races for the radio, and he did television as well. He was like the best at everything that had to do with horses and horse racing. How did his identity then become wrapped up in race calling itself?
Well, like you're saying, everyone associated Joe as being successful at anything that he attempted in this business of horse racing. And it did seem that almost everything that he touched would turn to gold.
But he was so beholden to being the race caller, he just did not want a race to go without him being the guy at the mic.
Right. At one point, he suffers a heart attack and still made it to the track. At another point, he was thrown off a horse and broke his hip and actually, you know, again, made it to the track. You know, at the end of his career, Joe had called 15,587 races in a row without ever having missed a single call. And it certainly meant a great deal to him that no matter, you know, what these adversities were, he was going to be at Santa Anita ready to call the races.
So, Rudy, tell me about Joe's last call.
Well, he had been at Hollywood Park that morning where he was kicked by a horse, and he shows up to Santa Anita Park shortly thereafter, and he goes to the first aid station and decides that he's not going to wait around for help. So he goes up to the booth, and he starts to call that first race of the day.
We've got tape of that final call. Let's listen to that now.
There they go. April Marie is going to the front. Oatman is second. Super Spirit is third.
As the horses are going around the back stretch, he faints at the microphone. Terry Gilligan and Dan Smith, who were at the press box, hear that the speakers have gone dead, and Dan Smith calls to Terry Gilligan, let's go down there and let's see what's going on with Joe. And they get there, and of course Joe is fainted at the microphone, and Dan Smith calls for help, and Terry Gilligan takes up the binoculars and goes to the window and starts calling the race and finishes it for Joe.
Okay, it's emergency.
Turning into the stretch, it's April Marie now.
And
in
what
front.
Happens next?
Well, then Joe is, taken to the Arcadia General Hospital, and he's there for about 3 days. 3 days later, he passes away.
Rudy, what are you thinking as you listen to Joe's last call?
So many times I came across Joe saying, if I can't perform, I'm not going to go up to the caller's booth. And then when people would ask him about the streak, you know, he would say, oh, it doesn't really mean that much to me. But it's very obvious at this particular moment when he's up there and he's in obvious pain that he was not going to let go of that streak without giving it a final try.
Well, Rudy, the book is wonderful. Thank you for sharing the story with us.
Well, thank you.
Rudy Alvarado is the author of The Untold Story of Joe Hernandez, The Voice of Santa Anita. The Kentucky Derby is tonight, 6:04. The horses are out of the gate. Big Brown is the favorite. There's a wonderful slideshow of the handsome Joe Hernandez at work, and there's more information about Rudy's book. You can visit our website at weekendamerica.org.
Citation is third by 2.5 lengths. Ponderous Force. Here's Tuli in front by a head. Noor is second, going to a drive. Here's Tuli and Noor driving hard. Citation is third. It's Noor and Tuli. It's Noor in front. Tuli is second. Citation and Ponder. It's Noor and Citation. They're coming down.
The biggest news in entertainment this weekend is not at the movie theater or the TV or even at Churchill Downs. The video game Grand Theft Auto 4 is out. Millions of people are buying it. Even if you haven't played the game, you've probably heard about the violence. Grand Theft Auto has been an icon of wanton video game killing. It is, though, not the first. Before Pac-Man and Space Invaders and Asteroids, there was a game called Death Race. It was 1976, and a little company called Exidy was trying to grab a piece of the video game pie.
Well, in the beginning of the video game industry, there was games, you know, the most famous one, of course, is Pong, where it was a black and white TV with a dot moving back and forth, and you hit it with a square paddle. My name is Howell Ivey, and I started in the games industry around 1972, very early on. At the time, we had a game called Destruction Derby. It was like a Demolition Derby type game. And we actually licensed to another game manufacturer at that time. And they were doing excellent sales with it. So I said, well, let's make it a little bit more exciting and change the obstacle cars there and the little stick figures, and let's chase after people. My partners thought that was a pretty good idea. It was very early in the 70s, long time before any of the hassles of violence came about. Nothing crossed our mind to say that anything was going to be controversial about the product. Death Race was in a black and white monitor, and it had two little block kind of cars on it, and we had little stick people running around on the screen. We called them gremlins or ghosts at the time, and the object was to chase after those stick people. Every time the car intersected a stick figure, it turned immediately into a cross until you had a whole screen full of little crosses where you'd be difficult to manipulate your car in between the crosses to chase the other little stick figures that was running around. So Some of the parents thought it was too much of a violent game where you were actually running down people, but that wasn't the intent of the entire game to begin with. You know, each person has their own perception of a painting or a product. Video games were in the infancy, and the controversy actually helped the sales of the game because of more of the operators who put the machines on locations. They actually found out about it, and they wanted to be part of the beginning of the video phenomenon. It's almost 35, 40 years later, and we're dealing with the same reaction to that type of product. The player on the game, you know, he's enjoying himself, and that's what we want to do with all of these games, is have the player enjoy the game. And by no means or even your imagination to go out and do these things in real life. You know, I'd rather do them in a fantasy space than even think about it in real life.
Howell Ivey created the video game Death Race in the 70s. Grand Theft Auto 4 is the king of video games this weekend.
Grand Theft Auto takes place in Liberty City, where it's always shady. But in Liberty, Kansas, it's full of sunshine. This weekend, it'll be a comfortable 70 degrees. For more weekend weather, here's John Moe.
Greensboro, North Carolina, thinks board games needn't be confined to a tabletop. They hold a life-size version of the kids' classic Candyland amid 74 degrees and thunderstorms. Might work out to a nice lesson, actually. The game represents how much fun candy is. The storms represent the ominous threat of tooth decay. See? Educational. Nice work, nature. Cloudy, 80 degrees as folks in Hamburg, Arkansas, is it okay to call them hamburgers? Celebrate an animal I like to call nature's bowling ball. The Armadillo Festival features pet show, fun run, and pageant. Is that pageant for people or armadillos? How would you judge an armadillo pageant? Shiniest shell? Best snout? Ability to form the most perfect sphere? Waikiki, Hawaii has clouds, 85 degrees, and processed meat in cans. It's Spam Jam with craft booths, entertainment stages, and spam. Don't be confused. It has nothing to do with email spam. The event is sponsored by the Deposed Nigerian Prince Foundation in conjunction with the American Federation of Lonely Girls Looking for Action. For information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm John Moe for Weekend America.
When funky Wu-Tang meets Yiddish klezmer. Oy vey. Yo, coming up on Weekend America.
Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert. Mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Online at calvert.com.
From American Public Media, this is Desiree Cooper with Bill Radke. Harlem's legendary Apollo Theater has launched some great performers, from Ella Fitzgerald to James Brown. Well, tonight, the Apollo debuts something new, the klezmer funk hip-hop group Abraham Inc. Reporter Michael May brings us the story behind the music.
David Krakauer is a third-generation American Jew. His great-grandparents and grandparents spoke Yiddish as their first language, and no wedding in their hometown in Russia would have been complete without a band playing that joyous Jewish secular music, klezmer. As a kid, Krakauer was obsessed with music.
It's a part of who we are, like quintessentially, fundamentally. For me, it's like my lifeblood.
But here's the thing. Krakauer's not talking about klezmer. His lifeblood is Black American music, jazz. That's what he fell in love with at age 11, and that's what he played on the clarinet in high school and college. He'd hardly heard klezmer until his 20s.
I grew up completely assimilated, you know, really even hardly going to synagogue or observing any holidays or anything like that.
The Holocaust destroyed klezmer music in Eastern Europe, and American Jews virtually abandoned it for jazz and pop. It wasn't until the 1970s that a few curious souls started digging out those old 78s and transcribing the melodies note for note. And now a new generation of Jews is reworking those old records. Josh Dolgan, a.k.a. So-Called, is a Jewish hip-hop producer who came to klezmer via the Wu-Tang Clan.
I was this rural white kid in Canada. Like, it seemed really kind of disingenuous and strange for me to be trying to make, like, this updated Black music. So I started collecting actively, like really looking for these Jewish records because they were full of amazing samples. They were full of these dope little breaks all the time.
So-Called and Krakauer met at a klezmer camp. They talked about the artists they loved, people like the klezmer king Naftali Brandwine and soul god James Brown, and decided to start working together. Last year, when they were contemplating sidemen for their new band, they got up the nerve to call their dream pick, Fred Wesley, the trombonist and arranger for James Brown and Parliament.
He just presented the project to me. And, you know, I was skeptical because, you know, I never heard much klezmer music before. But David had heard a lot of funk. Yeah, you know, and he was pretty sure that it would work, so he just convinced me.
And the music does work. See, klezmer's not polka. It's syncopated and funky. And Wesley knew immediately what to do.
You know, when you play funk, you get an attitude like, you know, we're busting down the doors, you know. We're tearing the roof off the sucker and stuff. But this music is happy. Like, we are bringing all people together. For instance, you heard the song Tweet Tweet? It's a nice song, you know. Everybody's happy, you know. But the rhythm that's under doom, doom, doom is sort of a knock the door down, tear the roof off the sucker kind of an attitude, you know?
And Krakauer made sure the ancient melodies still come through.
So-Called had made a beat, and the beat was taking an old klezmer rhythm, a Turkisher that sort of goes bum, 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 and speeding it up. And so then I took that tune, and then shredded it into little bits. And then we brought that tune to Fred. He put these funk hits underneath it. It didn't feel like we were trying to put a square peg into a round hole. You know, it just was happening.
You could make this into a metaphor about healing the sometimes fraught relationship between Blacks and Jews. For Wesley's part, he says he's just learned to dig Jewish culture.
It's more similarities than there are differences. I mean, like, we both like to eat. And we both like to dance and sing, and shaking your booty is very important to all peoples, all Jewish people and all black people. So that on that premise, we will come together, if nothing else, you know.
In New York City, I'm Michael May for Weekend America.
Had some great music. I hope the performance goes well tonight. The audiences at the Apollo are notoriously blunt.
Well, that's it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. It's produced by Ben Adair, Julia Barton, Jim Gates, who's climbing the rock walls this weekend, Millie Jefferson, cleaning out closets, Iacobi, Philip Stearns is gardening this weekend, we believe, clothed, Sam Keenan celebrating his girlfriend's birthday with something called PowerPoint Karaoke, Michael Rayfield, Tim Bamba, Angela Kim is combing garage sales this weekend for vintage cameras and records and treasures.
Also, Rob Byers, who's testing his average watts he can produce per hour on his bike. That's gotta hurt. Susie Lechtenberg, Chrissy Clark, Brendan Newnham, Michael May, David Banks is headed to his father's Cuatro de Mayo party in Santa Cruz. There's Phyllis Owens. John Moe is welcoming his baby daughter into the world this weekend. Mark Sanchez is also with us.
Galactic created our theme music. Executive producer Peter Clowney's fencing in his kids this weekend. Jim Russell created the program. You can get a free podcast of today's show at weekendamerica.org, and we hope you will. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. Remember, it's your weekend. Enjoy!
Weekend America, supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. This program is made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by American Public Media.
Hi, I'm Desiree Cooper, co-host of Weekend America. The weekends are for freedom.
Our job is to liberate them from the sensibilities and the conventions of their day-to-day life.
Now I just walk down the street and I'm like Mary Poppins. I'm free as a bird.
Forget the chores, the errands, and the weekend runaround. Liberate yourself with Weekend America, where great radio lives on the weekend.